I try to use my hymnal in my devotion time, and a lot of times it's the songs I don't know that I get more out of because I don't have the tune running through my head. I can actually focus on the words a little bit more. And lately it's been hymns where difficulties and sufferings are expressed, and just to realize, you know, Christians have been going through rough stuff for a long time, and they're able to come through and rejoice in the Lord. Well, a couple of weeks ago, sometime last month, we were in our Sunday evening study. We were looking at how they were studying, learning, their education processes, and I thought that was kind of interesting to see some of that. But tonight we're going to move on to the work of their hands. So we're going to start focusing on some of the occupations. And of course, as we think about occupations, right up at the top would be farming or agricultural things. And it is very important, really, to understand that, because so much of the scriptures give us pictures and illustrations of truth through the agricultural element. And sometimes, you know, we kind of take it for granted a little bit, being an agricultural community. We know a little bit more about growing things and what it takes. But, you know, really, we have come so far in the last 100 years in farming that we are still quite a bit divorced from the realities of that day. But farming didn't change that much from the times of the scriptures all the way up to the mid-1800s. For the most part, they were doing things the same way. You know, it was a lot of physical, hands-on labor. You were working with animals, livestock, using horses and oxen in order to accomplish the tasks. You couldn't do thousands of acres. You just wouldn't have had the manpower and the ability. And really not until those late 1800s, early 1900s, innovations have come along. I remember Mom and Dad bought an acreage, and it was totally overgrown, and Dad handed us boys one of these. We want a camp spot, so go out there and chop down the weeds and everything, and we were really struggling trying to figure out how to use this thing until Granddad came along, and he says, "Let me show you how it's done." And first thing he would want to do would be sharpen it. And then he knew the technique of how to run that. But we weren't putting it through, you know, nice, easy grass. We were trying to chop down multiple rows and currant bushes and things, gooseberry bushes. This is old technology. But I don't know how far back this goes. It's quite a bit of a step up from this, though. Because you could stand up and work with that. With this thing, you would be bent over all day trying to cut your wheat. You'd cut it, bundle it up by hand, whereas with this, some of them had catchers and things on it that caught the bundle and you just had to tie it. But, you know, these are pretty rudimentary tools. And they haven't changed that much down through the years. And so we're going to think about some of that tonight as we look at farming. Farming was going to be a difficult labor. We know that from clear back Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve sinned, and it's by the sweat of our brow that we're going to eat bread. And Israel would have been very familiar with the agricultural element, of course, being involved with cattle or livestock, sheep and things, but also In Egypt, they would have been exposed to a lot of agriculture, growing crops. And in Egypt, they were very dependent upon the yearly flood of the Nile. The waters came up and fertilized the land, deposited fresh soils, and then receded. And they would be able to use the Nile to draw water off of through channels and different methods of irrigation. But when God brought them out of Egypt, Moses warned them as they were going into the land that farming was going to be different in the land of Canaan. They weren't going to be reliant upon the Nile and the ability to divert waters and irrigation. They're going to be dependent upon the rain. And they had to be careful that they did not fall into the worship of the false gods that were supposedly promising power over the rain. Baal would have been a storm god. And it was so tempting when you're dependent. You put that seed in the ground and it's kind of a dry, arid area anyway, and you've got to have the rain. So it was going to be a little more difficult for them. The tools were crude by comparison to today, and the inability to fight disease and bugs and plagues of nature, we take it a lot for granted. If we have poor soil, we can go to the co-op and buy lime, or we can buy chemical fertilizers and have those put on the ground. If we have bugs, we've got chemicals for that. If we have disease, we've got chemicals for that. They didn't have all of that. And so if you had depletion of your soil, it took years to rebuild. And if God brought locusts and things, there was just nothing you can do about it. And those things were seen as judgments. Of course, a very basic farm tool is the plow. When we think of a rudimentary plow, in our minds, I think we kind of go back to that picture in the top there. You have a steel plow. It turns the soil, a couple of handles to help you, drawn by oxen and then later by a small tractor or something. That wasn't invented until the late 1800s. And before that, most of the plows were more similar to that bottom picture. If we weren't talking about plows and I just handed you that picture, you'd be like, what's this? You know, it's just two beams that are kind of tied together at odd angles. But that's what it was. And as, you know, the development of the plow, as you became able to use metals and things, they might put a metal tip on that because wood doesn't hold up very well when you're dragging it through the dirt. You're dragging it over rocks and stones and hard chunks of dirt and things, and so it would wear out. So, of course, one of the first things they did was to put some kind of a metal tip on it. But it was very hands-on work. You had to make sure to be paying attention to what you were doing. They would use a donkey or oxen, usually oxen, and those would be, see if I get my terminology right, a steer, the heifer's the girl, right? Okay, this is a steer. And so that's significant as we're going to be looking into some of these verses. It was best to have a matched set of animals, or else the yoke would cause harm to your animal. That wouldn't be good. You want to take care of those animals because that's your livelihood. The farmer would carry a goad to guide the oxen. It was a long stick And on the tip of it would be sharpened to a point, or later they put a metal tip on it of some kind. I read somewhere, and I wish I could remember this better, but it seemed like with cows and horses are different maybe, but you reach out with the goat and just touch them on their flanks and they will move accordingly. And I can't remember, I think a cow moves into it and a horse moves away from it or something, but you just had to put it out there and touch them, and that would help direct their path. But sometimes they got kind of obstinate. Maybe they're getting tired, they don't want to work today, and they're just standing there. Maybe they found something interesting in the dirt or whatever. They're watching the birds go by or something, and you want them to plow, and they don't respond to your voice commands. You could reach out there and give them a good poke in the rear end and get them moving again. And that's that goad. You goaded them on. And we still kind of even use that terminology now, even though, you know, we haven't used goads in years in the physical sense. But it was a guide as well as a prod to work. The plowing had to be done in season. It's a more of an arid area. The soil would get very hard when it was dry. And so they waited for the rains to start. And the rain would come and soften the soil, which would allow them to get that plow down into the soil. And these plows, they weren't turning 16 inches of dirt. They'd plow 3 or 4 inches of dirt. And they'd make these stripes across the field, and they're just breaking up enough of the topsoil to be able to get a seed bed for their grain crops. And so, you know, they weren't getting breaking up hard pan. If they had to do that, they had to get out a mattock and hack away by hand to break up that hard soil. So a lot of work to be involved in that. Because it was slow work and hard work, the one that was plowing would stop and sow what he had plowed. And so today we think of, in terms of farming, you pretty much go into the field and you work that field. We don't do as much plowing anymore, but you would go and plow the field, and then you would come back and plant the field. Might be a separate day or something. But here, they would plow for a while, and once they got a decent piece of ground plowed up, they would take a break and pull out the seed and sow the seed over that area. Because it might take days upon days to plow a field. And so, you know, rain's going to come. You don't know when the rain's going to stop and that sort of thing. So what you get planted today may get the rain that what you get at the end of the field you might not get if you waited. So also, because it's so hard and focused work, it was good to take a break. You know, a change of work is about as good as a rest anyway. And so they would break up their work that way. Let's take what we've just learned about plowing and look at some of these verses, and we'll discuss them as we go. Luke chapter 9 and verse 62. Okay, he's using an illustration of no one putting his hand to the plow is to look back. Why is that? Okay. That's one of the possibilities. If you're too busy looking back over your shoulder, you're not looking where you're going. And you don't know what your oxen are doing. They may be veering off to find some fresh food or something. If you're too busy looking behind, you're not looking ahead. But there's more to it than that. Okay. Yes, a divided heart. There was enough work in plowing you didn't have time to be looking around. You had to watch what you were doing. You had cattle to take care of. You had to plow a straight furrow. You had to watch what was going on with that tip of your plow, because your plow is weak. And you didn't want that plow to be drug into a boulder. It would break your plow. And so you had to watch, and you had to lift that plow up and put it back in the ground. And you had to make sure that that plow was digging, because if you weren't putting down pressure, or the angle of your plow wasn't just riding just right, it would just pop out of the ground and bounce along the top of the soil. You had enough to do in the task at hand that you didn't have time to be looking behind you. And I think that's part of this picture here, that when we are given a task in the kingdom of God, there's enough to be focused on it. There's work to be done. It's enough to be focused on the present. We don't have time to be worrying about the past. And I think that goes to what Paul was saying, forgetting those things which are behind, I press toward the mark. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 10. And then 2 Corinthians 6:14. Okay, so we use another law that was given to Israel, but it was also an illustration of how we are to attach ourselves to other believers, especially in marriage. Why did you not put an ox and an ass together? Different sizes, different strengths. They're going to behave differently. They have different needs. And when you are unequally yoked, that yoke is chafing. Just not even when you're doing work, but it's just sitting there at an odd angle. It's not fitting properly around the neck of the animal. And then you add work to that, and one's pulling hard and the other one can't pull and keep up, and you put everything in a bind, and it causes harm. There's pain involved. There's damage that's involved. And the work that you should be able to accomplish, you can't get done. And so it's telling us there, it's not just it's not just the size difference, but there's real harm that takes place when you put two people together that are not equally yoked. It's going to cause damage. Hosea 10, verse 11. Okay, let's also look at Judges 14, 18. Okay, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have solved my riddle. I wouldn't have known without studying the significance of his statement. You don't plow with heifers. You did use heifers to thresh out the grain. You use the steers to plow with. And so what he's saying is, you've done something totally inappropriate. You've been messing around with my girl. If you hadn't been messing with my girl, you would never have figured this out. You get to that Hosea 10. It started off with, was it Ephraim? Was a heifer that loved to thresh the grain. Why would a heifer love to thresh out the grain? Can you remember? We'll get to it here in a minute if we don't. They got to eat it. You didn't keep the animal that was threshing the grain from eating the grain that they were working on. And so she's growing fat. This is fun work, you know? Just walk in circles and eat. He says, I'm taking you as a heifer who is normally threshing grain, and I'm going to put you on the plow. That's hard work. There's no food. Wrong time of the year, right? You go out in the spring and nothing's been planted, you don't have anything on that ground. And it's hard work. It's a judgment from God. Proverbs 20 in verse 4. It's not like today where we have so much horsepower in our tractors that we could go out in pretty much any time of the year and run a ripper if we had to. I mean, it's not ideal. We know that. But they had to have those rains to get the plow to work. If you didn't get your work done in season, you couldn't plow. If you couldn't plow, you couldn't plant. If you couldn't plant, you're not going to have a harvest. And so the lazy man who looks at the weather and says, oh, it's raining this week, I think I'll wait, I don't want to mess around in the mud, ends up allowing all of that time of the spring plowing season to pass him by. And when it finally dries up and he gets out the plow doesn't want to go through the soil, or he gets done and it's too late to plant. And so he ends up going hungry. Psalm 129 and verse 3. In a lot of these agricultural illustrations, they're taken to a negative. They can be used both ways. You know, plowing, preparing the soil, getting a harvest, that's all very good things. But then they're so familiar with the hardship of the work and the imagery of what's taking place. You have this virgin ground that you're taking a beam of wood and just ripping up the ground. It's violent. And so they take those imagery and just the practical day-to-day life things that they would have been very familiar with, and they bring them into other lessons. And here we see somebody who has been brought through judgment. They've used a whip on their back. And rather than talking about a whip and how it would rip the skin and make long tracks in their back, they talk about it like as if they were plowing, ripping up the ground in long furrows. It's a poetic imagery. Isaiah 28 and verse 24. Okay, does he? What did we learn in our previously? Does he keep plowing and plowing and plowing? He doesn't. He stops and he plants some seed. And then he plows some more and he stops and he plants some seed. Okay. Jeremiah 26 and verse 18. Okay, and so we see this aspect of judgment. And God likens it to plowing. Put it on a grand scale. Just like the plow plowing through the field uproots the little pieces of grass, it goes right through all of the little ant hills and destroys everything and turns it all up. So God is going to bring judgment upon Israel, and it's going to be like as if he just took a plow and ran it right through the city of Jerusalem. Houses overturned, everything's in turmoil. Everything's uprooted. Let's go to Proverbs 21 and verse 4. The plowing of the wicked is sin. Hosea 10 verses 4 and 13. I think the idea here, and I could be wrong, but the idea of plowing and planting was so closely associated that when you're talking about the plowing of the wicked, is also the aspect of sowing their seed. And you're going to reap what you sow. You plan your work and you've worked your soil, put your seed in there, and what's coming up? It's the things that you sowed. And so I think that's kind of what they're getting at in those verses. Luke 17, 7 through 10. Plowing and planting the field was hard work. And you send a servant out to do it. If you were rich, you don't want to do the work yourself, right? So you have a servant. As servant, you send out to do the work. He works, he comes in at the end of the day, and you tell him, sit down and have a meal. You've done such wonderful work for me. No, the process wasn't that way. The servant comes in and says, now it's mealtime, go in and fix my meal. However hard the task was, there was another task to be done. And you look back at the previous verses, and he's talking about forgiveness. Forgiving your brother, 70 times 7. And the disciples said, Lord, increase our faith. I don't think we can do this. He says, you can do hard things. It doesn't take a lot of faith. It's your duty. You do it, and don't expect to get patted on the back. Don't do it because you're looking for some recognition or reward. You do it because it's your duty. 1 Corinthians 9, 7 through 11. You go through the hard work of plowing the field, sowing the crop, waiting for the harvest. You do it all in hope, a anticipation, a confidence that there's going to be a result. And it's judgment when it doesn't for Israel. God had promised if they would obey him and follow his commands, he would bless them, their work would be profitable. But when they did not, it was a judgment from God that they planted and somebody else eats their harvest. And so this is a natural law. Somebody that goes to the work ought to receive the benefit of the labors. And so he puts that on to the supporting those in spiritual work, not just physical work. Tools of the harvest. The number of tools that would have been used, and many of these are directly mentioned in Scripture. There is, of course, the sickle. And the early sickles, that's what's up there in that left-hand corner. Oftentimes it was just a curved stick with pieces of flint embedded on the inside edge of it. And we think of rocks, we probably don't think rocks being very sharp. But flint, when it is properly napped, is extremely sharp. It's as sharp as a razor blade. And so they'd put those on the inside there, and it would just act like a knife through the grain. But it is a lot of work, and you would lose the teeth. They'd get loose and fall out. So it wasn't the best. And so as they developed metals, and by the time of David, Saul, they would have had metal that they were using. They had to go down to the Philistines to get their implements sharpened because they weren't allowed to have these things. But the sickle, it's a lot of hard work. You had to be bent over all day to use it. You cut off the upper part of the crop, and later you probably brought in sheep to graze the stubble. There's the threshing floor, which is a large flat area, sometimes a stone, or if not stone, they would compact the ground because you didn't want pieces of dirt and stuff getting into your crop. You're going to eat that. And you don't want to use up your teeth on pieces of gravel. So they'd pack it down hard so that that grain wouldn't fall into a crack or something and get lost or wasted. It would be on the hill where the wind would blow regularly. And then in the off season, in the spring, it was a good place to pitch your tents. If you can imagine, you've done all this work, you've brought the grain crop in, and the process of threshing, you've beat and pounded and scraped and everything. Well, you've pounded little seeds of crop into the soil. And so come spring rains, it's all going to spring up green, whereas all of the rest of the land has to be worked and sown. That was already pre-sowed. And so it would be a beautiful place to come in the spring and pitch your tents. The flail was a long, flexible stick used to separate the heads of the grain from the straw. You wanted to have a tool that was going to break the straw but not mash the grain. And so you would be careful that what you were using for that. Oftentimes they would use oxen and a treading pole. They'd put a pole in the middle of the threshing floor and tie their oxen off to it, and a little boy would walk that oxen in a circle all day long. And the adults would be scooping in and out the straw and the stuff that had to be broken down. In fact, the word thresh comes from the another word that meant to tread out. You want to be as effective as possible, and so they invented some things. They invented sledges. That's not a hammer, not a sledgehammer. These were boards with flint teeth that were set into their bottom and drug over top of it, so those flint sharp teeth would just shred the haystack. You can see that in that middle picture there. They used the weight of the man on the sledge to force it down into the grain as the oxen tread it out around in a circle. Later, they came up with some rollers that went on the sledges, and the rollers had been embedded with flint teeth, and so it churned it up. Sometimes they'd use a threshing wheel or just drive their carts across the grain, anything they could do to effectively break down the grain. There's a winnowing fan, and that's not a box fan. It's not the fan you fan yourself with. It was a fork. This one is a nice hay fork. It's missing a tooth. But theirs would have had about 5 teeth, probably made out of wood, and it would be able to jam into that pile of straw and throw it up into the air. They also had winnowing shovels, but you know how hard it is to put a shovel into a pile of hay? Well, you started with this, and you tossed it up, and when you got the largest particles out of it, then you could use the shovel and keep going when this would no longer pick it up. And after they winnowed it, throwing it up in the air, the wind comes through, takes the chaff out, the heavy, valuable grain falls back to the ground. Well, it still has a lot of junk in it. And so they used sieves to sift the grain. This is a lot of work. To harvest it, bundle it, haul it to the threshing floor, spread it out, thresh over it, winnow it, sieve it, and then you had to sit there and pick through it and pick out all of the tare seeds, because they were bitter and even poisonous, and so you had to make sure to separate the tares out. Well, I've got a lot of verses. We're not going to have time to get through them all, but I want to get to some of these. Judges chapter 6 and verse 11. Okay, you use a flail to thresh out small amounts of grain. When you have a whole harvest, you don't want to be doing that with a flail. That's why they use their oxen or the sledges. And to thresh out grain, you wanted wind. And when you're in a man-made pit, you don't get a lot of wind. You ever go down into a pit, you get out of the breeze. There's no wind. When you have no wind, it just makes more and more work as you're trying to separate that grain. You throw it up, it just falls right back down. And so it was not a good situation. And he's trying to hide his crop And he's going to extreme measures and a tremendous amount of work to do this. Now, let's like drop down to verse 37. Okay, Gideon threshed his wheat at the bottom of the hill in a pit. Now we find him sleeping up on the top of the hill. Just thinking about that a little bit. Why would he be up there? He's watching. He wants to see what's going on. It's a vantage point. But if you're wanting to make a test about dew, where would you put your bed? Where's the least likely place that you're going to have dew? On the top of the hill where the wind blows. I don't think he really wanted to get the answer he was getting. Let's see. Oh, there's so many good ones here. I can't remember all of them. Proverbs 20 and 26. He sifts out the wicked and brings the threshing wheel over them. Can you imagine that imagery of a threshing sledge or a threshing wheel which just goes over and over and over that pile of grain? What a terrible imagery. A king sifts out the wickedness and brings the judgment. Kind of like that plowing the back as be the result of that. Well, we're out of time tonight, and maybe we'll come back to these verses next week.